Hello and welcome to Weapons and Warfare for Straight Arrow News. I'm your host, Ryan Robertson, and this week we're talking NATO, innovation on the battlefield, and a comms check with some experts in comms. At the recently concluded AFA Warfare Symposium, we heard from some of the smartest voices in NATO. While they stayed away from the politics, they painted a very real picture about what an unchecked Russia would mean for Europe and the world at large. And AFRL, the Air Force Research Laboratory, is at it again, delivering innovation to the troops who need it with an idea that may just help save some lives. But first, here's some headlines you may have missed. If you watched our episode a couple of weeks back, you may have seen our debrief on the idea of using U.S. military troops to take on Mexican drug cartels. Asked about the potential for ground forces during a visit to the U.S.-Mexico border, Vice President J.D. Vance says U.S. forces will not invade Mexico, despite the president designating drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, opening the door for potential military action.
I'm not going to make any announcements about any invasions of Mexico here today. The president has a megaphone, and of course he'll speak to these issues as he feels necessary. But what designating cartel organizations allows us to do is deploy the full resources of the United States military to engage in serious border enforcement.
Vance went to Eagle Pass, Texas, along with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, to tout a drop in illegal border crossings. Remember that promotional anime video introducing Anduril's Barracuda 500 autonomous air vehicle? Well, they've gone from 2D to 3D, just 7 months after being chosen for the Enterprise Test Vehicle Project. Anduril and the Barracuda pulled off a successful flight test. We know because they put it on Instagram. Up next, Anduril plans to showcase the Barracuda 500's ability to work autonomously with other systems. But wait, there's more. Anduril also recently clinched a $642 million contract for the Marine Corps installation Counter Small Unmanned Aircraft Systems program, which is basically a network of defenses against drones for military bases and facilities. This news follows a $200 million deal Anduril secured in November to provide counter-drone technology for the Marine Air Defense Integrated System, or MADIS. This mobile air defense system can be installed on vehicles such as the Humvee. For decades, America's role in NATO was unquestioned, as certain as death and taxes. There was no doubt aggression in Europe would be met by the U.S. and its European allies. Now, for the first time since its inception in 1949, that commitment is coming into question. And while no one yet knows exactly what the future holds, the people charged with making sure NATO is ready to meet any threat, regardless of the current political rhetoric, are keeping their eyes focused on the task at hand. And that's the subject of this week's debrief. During the first full week of March, a panel of experts gathered in an oversized ballroom in Aurora, Colorado, nearly 6,000 miles away from the fighting in Ukraine,
Slava Ukraine!
To talk about Russia's illegal invasion and where the North Atlantic Treaty Organization stands today.
At NATO, the role of the Ops Division is threefold in six words. Prevent war, support Ukraine, and defend allies. To prevent war, NATO has troops in Kosovo and in Iraq, and NATO activities that are dynamically managed by SACUR on a daily basis in order to prevent Russia and all of our adversaries from perceiving an advantage in either any geographic domain, in any warfighting domain, or in readiness.
That's 32 countries, including the United States, that have sworn to protect each other and defend against bad actors, like Russia and Vladimir Putin. And as Tom Goffis, the Assistant Secretary General for NATO Operations, detailed, even though Ukraine is not a NATO nation, the response to Russia's invasion did not go unchecked.
To support Ukraine, the Ops Division underpins the pillars of NATO's work for Ukraine, including the NATO support and training assistance to Ukraine in Wiesbaden, Germany, the $40 billion pledge for military assistance to Ukraine that all allies made last year in DC, of which in 2024, we hit $51 billion. That's $11 billion more than was pledged. By the way, almost 60% of that was from non-US allies.
Brigadier General Andrew Clark is the commanding general for NATO intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. He told attendees, no matter what's happening stateside, for troops stationed in Europe, the job remains.
So the advantage is we provide that unfiltered intelligence to all those nations. And so what I like to tell people is that in the U.S. we have the DGS system, the Distributed Common Ground System, that PEDs the information that aircraft in our Air Force collect, but we do it all in-house. We're one-stop shop. We have about 150 analysts on the ground there, and our products put out about roughly 10,000 products a year is the rate we're at right now.
For our European counterparts, like Italian Air Force Lieutenant General Luigi Del Beni, Deputy Commander and Chief of Staff for Operational Forces of the 1st Air Region Command, the success of this decades-old pact depends on making sure 32 move as one.
One of the biggest challenges is keeping the nations involved into this process and make sure that we're synchronized to the all different changes that Secure and Shape are running every day together with the components. That's from my perspective. The good part of that is that I've seen through the last couple of years a definitely more focused leadership on readiness, which it's a good fact that people are taking this specific function more and more seriously.
Of course, invariably, the conversation continued to return to Ukraine, Russia's illegal invasion, and what's been learned in the years since.
Lesson number one, collective action rests on the foundation of shared awareness, and it takes real work to achieve that shared awareness. And unlike in 2014, where ambassadors were arguing, they're looking at pictures saying, see, the Russians are in Crimea. And the next ambassador would say, no, that looks like a hunter to me. And as a result, we didn't do anything because we didn't have shared awareness of what was going on. Our 2022 response couldn't have been more different than the 2014 response in primary part due to shared intelligence among allies, especially from the US. And so lesson number two is, it's not what we do that provokes Putin. It's what we don't do. We should have learned that in 2014. And that's lesson number three, which is Putin is not a strategist. He's an opportunist. He pushes on some doors, and when nobody pushes back, he walks in. What 2014 taught him was there was no significant consequence for using force.
As for President Donald Trump's demand, NATO nations need to be spending more on national defense. Part of the problem is an inability for American defense contractors to meet the needs of their customers.
I talked to a Lithuanian, and with their extra percentage of GDP in defense spending, they want to buy AMRAAMs for their NASAMs. 5-year wait. I talked to the Bulgarian Chad. They want to buy Javelins for their Strikers. 7-year wait. I talked to some of the big allies who want to buy Patriots. 10-year wait. Again, that needs to get fixed. And I know that industry will tell you what we need is long-term demand. Well, 10 years sounds like long-term demand to me. There is something that we need to get there in there and fix.
Given the current political climate, the panelists all acknowledge there are no quick fixes to any of the issues facing NATO partner nations. The one thing that should be clear, they say, is an unchecked Russia will make waves that reach far beyond Europe. Because letting Putin off the hook will embolden China, and they say create a new set of problems in the Pacific.
Serving you clarity through context, our mission at SAN is to deliver the news straight down the middle. We're different from mainstream media because we spotlight distorted headlines and show you how to do it too. Discover stories that right and left-leaning outlets are choosing not to cover by using our Media Mist tool. Download the SAN app and turn on notifications to have straight facts delivered right to your phone or tablet, and get straight facts anytime at SAN.com.
Time now for Weapon of the Week, and we here at Weapons and Warfare give this segment a lot of latitude. From helmets to tactical cameras and underwater drones, we see a weapon as any thing or tactical concept that our troops can take to the fight and win. And that brings us to one of the latest efforts from the good folks at the Air Force Research Lab.
So you two now with us.
One of the ugliest truths about armed conflict is people get hurt. Fortunately for American troops, when that happens, they can count on highly skilled and highly capable medical professionals. And now, thanks to this piece of equipment, those professionals can provide an even better level of treatment during the golden hour, the period of time right after sustaining an injury, when care is most critical.
So what we have behind us is called the Tactical Anesthesia Workstation. This is a iterative development to save the warfighter and bring heroes home. So it's meant for our far forward surgical teams all the way at the front line, providing damage control surgery, helping save lives.
If it looks like something you might see at the bedside of any patient in a hospital, that's kind of the point. At this year's AFA Warfare Symposium, Lieutenant Colonel Derek Sorensen told us that until the introduction of the Tactical Anesthesia Workstation, all of the gear you see would most likely be sitting on a floor, or maybe even on the ground itself.
Now it's organized, it's structured, helps save lives and improve care in that space. So now it's transitioned through those iterative processes, and it's actually out in the field with our ground surgical teams providing care and saving lives.
But the problem was not fully addressed until the AFRL and the 711th Human Performance Wing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base paired up to find a workable solution.
I think a lot of the challenges is our commercial partners that all these devices come from medical devices, they don't have a need to make a station that can go out in the dirt and play. And we're not a big customer like all the hospitals and the medical system across the world. And so this is where that unique thing of taking your operational SMEs that live in our training pipelines, pairing them with all of our experts in S&T and engineers just across the street at AFRL, and we solve a really hard, complex problem, and we have ways to speed it faster than anything.
The part of that solution came with how they decided to introduce the stand to medical personnel.
Like I said, we actually fielded it first in the training pipeline, so all the folks come through before they go out in the field, and so we use that as a tight OODA loop because our engineers were right there, the instructors were there, we could see performance decrements where people were struggling, make adjustments before we went into final production to kick it out into the field for field testing, which really helped us be super fast.
Colonel Sorensen went on to say the stand can already be found at nearly 40 bases and will be deployed with medical teams posting up anywhere near the action. Back in November, we introduced you to Persistent Systems, a Colorado-based company that specializes in mobile ad hoc networking technology. At the time, they had inked a deal with the Air Force Mobility Command to fortify their communication systems. Now, they're taking things a step further with a new piece of hardware, and that's the subject of this week's comms check. It's called the Personal Transport 5, or the PT5, and the folks at Persistent Systems say it's the next evolution in connectivity for troops on the ground.
What we're doing is we're adding some hardware to the side of the system, so it's backward compatible to all the thousands of systems that are already out there. And what it's doing is it's allowing us to access not only Wi-Fi, but also cellular networks for multiple locations, whether it's in the United States or abroad. And that allows us to kind of extend the network that's created by the existing system beyond line of sight and integrated to the cloud. So whether you're connected to the cloud for a government cloud solution or a private cloud solution, now the mesh network is able to access all the data within that cloud.
So walk me through like a real world situation. If I'm a dismounted soldier and I have this radio, I can take over an aerial drone at that point? If it's connected to the system, I can have access to it. Is that right?
Absolutely. Whether it's in the air, ground, swarming weapons, all of the technology now is part of its same network, and you're able to interact with the data coming off of it. You're able to provide AI-enhanced features to it with data fusion and course corrections and different types of applications that can exist. And it all happens real time, very low latency and high throughput with a lot of scale. So lots, hundreds of thousands of nodes all at the same time now connected.
The PT-5 is the latest example of how Persistent Systems is working to meet the needs of each branch of the U.S. military as they continue to modernize and prepare for America's next conflict.
Especially as a non-traditional contractor, our goal is to outpace requirements, outpace the needs, the EW environment, everything. So we're constantly moving. We have teams out all over, engineering resources that are collecting information from all the different services, depending on where they're operating, whether it's an unmanned system, manned system, anywhere in the world, the cloud interactions, the AI portions of that. Every few months, something's coming out with new features.
All opinions expressed in this segment are solely the opinions of the contributors.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for us on this episode of Weapons and Warfare. As always, if you like what you saw, please like and subscribe to our social media channels. We want to grow our audience, and we'd sure appreciate your help doing just that. For my wrap this week, I want to spend a little bit of time on something that happened in the last couple of weeks that hit me harder than I was expecting. The death of Gene Hackman and his wife, Betsy R. Kawa. Hackman was a Marine before he was an actor, serving in China, Japan, and Hawaii. When he went to Hollywood, he eventually played some of the most iconic roles in some of my favorite movies.
I expect and demand your very best. Anything less, you should have joined the Air Force.
He's got one barrel left. When he fires that, take out your pistols and shoot him down like a mangy scoundrel he is.
I need that ball. Get me the ball.
You need the ball.
Get me the ball.
Get you the ball.
Or are you going to get me the ball?
I'll get you the ball!
Details about their deaths are still coming to light, but we know Hackman and his wife lived in a very large home in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We know Betsy Arakawa died of hantavirus. And Hackman, who suffered from Alzheimer's, died about a week later. A dog that was locked in a closet died of starvation because Hackman and his wife weren't found for weeks. Gene Hackman was extremely successful. From the outside, it would seem he had everything he could ever want. But he and his wife were dead and gone from this world for quite some time before anyone knew. To me, that's tragic. I don't think about my own death all that much. I don't think really any of us should. But when it's my time to go, my hope is I've made enough of an impact on the people around me that they notice when I'm gone. Hackman and his wife obviously lived a very private life. As it turned out, maybe a little too private. And the irony is they could have had people to lean on. People like family, friends, maybe even hired help. Because eventually we all need help. Asking for it isn't giving up your independence. It's okay to admit you need help. It's okay to ask for it. Odds are, someone you know is willing to give it. For senior producer Brett Baker, video editor Brian Spencer, and graphics artist Dakota Patillo, I'm Ryan Robertson with Straight Arrow News, signing off.